here with me now is somebody, he's got a book about his life that we'll talk about in a few moments or so. You might know him most from Blues Project and Blood, Sweat, and Tears, but his early years also include hanging out with people like Dave Van Ronk and also Reverend Gary Davis and John Hurt and others throughout Greenwich Village. We'll talk a little bit about all of that, but he's also here in the present, and it's a real pleasure to welcome Steve Katz.
Sometimes in winter, I gaze into the streets, walk through snow and city sleet behind your room. Sometimes in winter, forgotten memories remember you behind the trees with leaves that cry. By the window once I waited for you, laughing slightly you would run. Trees alone would shield us in the meadow, making love in the evening sun. Now you're gone, girl, and the lampposts call your name. I can hear them in a spring of frozen rain. Now you're gone, girl, and the times slow down till dawn. It's a cold room, and the walls ask where you've gone. Sometimes in winter, I love you when the good times seem like memories in the spring that never came. Sometimes in winter, I wish the empty streets filled with laughter from your tears to ease my pain.
Steve Katz, thank you for playing that.
Thank you.
That song must get a lot of requests, does it?
It does, yeah.
It really stood out on that album as a superb song. I mean, that album is probably one everybody talks about, but the one before it was a terrific album as well.
That's the one that everybody loves more, yeah.
The child is father to the man. And the cover on that is... still makes me smile.
Yeah.
Whenever I see that cover.
Alfred Gescheit, I think, was the photographer's name, and he was pre-Photoshop.
Yeah. Where did those little figures come from?
They were models. Yeah. They were kids.
Oh, they were real kids.
Yeah, okay. And it's online. You can actually see the original kids. They're a bunch of little brats.
Yeah, these kids are miniature versions of the musicians, and it's a really great album cover.
Yeah.
So. I guess there's so much I could ask you about. I'd love to know a little bit about your childhood. Where did you grow up? And I know you eventually kind of knocked around Greenwich Village. How did this all happen?
Well, do you mean my early childhood? Because I started singing on the streets of Queens when I was like 4 or 5 years old.
Wow.
Because I used to listen to, and I loved, even at this early age, I loved Eddie Fisher and Perry Como and all of those. So on a hot summer day, I would go down with my underpants and an undershirt and sing for the neighborhood.
The stoop was your stage?
The stoop was my stage, and people threw change at me. And I would go to I would save up and then, you know, go to the record store and buy records. And things have not changed.
Wow.
71 years, and it hasn't changed.
I still
play in my underpants in my neighborhood. And I run immediately to the record store.
It's no Eddie Fisher. There hasn't been much new Eddie Fisher.
Right. The only difference is that everything's in stereo now.
Well, that what did your family think about that as you were out there? You're bringing in
they
somebody.
Thought I was crazy. The whole neighborhood thought I was crazy. And
I'll bet. When did you first pick up an instrument? Was guitar?
I first picked up guitar when just before I took lessons from Dave Van Ronk. And I loved folk music, but I really loved country blues and bluegrass, old-timey music. And I loved listening to it, but I wanted to play it. And since I was singing a cappella by myself, I wanted to be able to accompany myself. And I went into Greenwich Village, and I went to the Folklore Center.
Now, how old are you now?
I was like 15 years old.
Okay.
And it was Izzy Young's Folklore Center. They rented guitars, and I rented a guitar and thought, I got myself a block of resin because I figured, well, if violin players use resin, then it probably works for the guitar and be easier to play. So I put resin on my strings, and when I made a chord, I couldn't move my string, my fingers anywhere, and realized that was the wrong thing to do. So, I took my rented guitar down to the Gaslight, and I asked Dave Van Ronk if he taught, and he said yes. In those days, the Village was very different than just a few years later, because it was still the beatnik transition. And out on the streets, you could smell coffee and espresso and, you know, coming from the Figaro and the Fat Black Pussycat and the French cigarettes, the Gauloises and the Gitons. And
this is like late 50s.
Late 50s, yeah. And I'm talking about 1961.
Yeah.
And it was just when Bob Dylan had come in from Wisconsin and Jim Queskin was around this, and a lot of these guys were staying at the Van Ronks. Dylan, when I first took my first lesson with Dylan up on West 15th Street, I'm with Van Ronk, Dylan was sleeping on the couch. And when you read a lot of stories about the Village in those days, Dylan's always sleeping on somebody's couch. I think he's probably slept on every couch in Greenwich Village.
Well, that had to be, do you remember when you first saw the beatnik scene and took that in?
Yeah, I saw the end of it. I saw people reciting poetry with berets on, and I never saw people dancing where they did beatnik dancing, you know, with the girls with the leotards and stuff like that. And,
but the kind of imprint that leaves on you as a 15-year-old has to be just incredible. Maybe you were more prepared for it than I would be, but to be plopped into a situation like that.
Well, I loved it. Yeah. I mean, I loved the whole hippie. I mean, the whole beatnik culture. I loved the music, the cool jazz, and I loved the poetry, the literature, of course. You know, on the road and stuff like that. And I really, you know, fell into that New Directions paperback kind of scene, and I really did love it. But by the time the folk music thing in the Village was sort of the bridge between the whole hippie 1965 scene and the one before it, which was like up until 1960. And those 5 years was what Van Ronk used to refer to as the Great Folk Scare.
Yeah. This is Steve Katz, and I suspect a lot of these stories are in the memoir that you wrote, and I haven't had a chance to read it yet. It's gotten great reviews. I've read little snippets of it. That had to be a great book to write. Did you find as you were writing it that more memories were coming out?
Exactly. Yeah. When you start, it's like an empty canvas, you know, and And what I started with was certain things that were really familiar, you know, more modern things. And then when I went back in time, it just opened up a whole thing. You start a sentence and then you think about things that happened. And it was just a whole process that really was a ton of fun. I mean, it took 2 years to do, but it was really a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And the great thing is that also the people that read it are telling me that they're Googling some of the blues people that I mentioned that are obscure, you know, and they're listening to that. These people have never been exposed to some of the great blues musicians and old-timey musicians.
That's a blessing. You know, Mississippi John Hurt, for example, you might be introducing people to him who did not know about him. And I know you spent time with Reverend Gary Davis, too.
I took lessons from Reverend Davis for a little while. It was very difficult because he used a finger pick and the Dave Van Ronk style was very different. So I wound up road managing Reverend Davis for a while. And I would drive him to gigs and try to learn things, you know, in the hotel room that night. We would share a room. And he was terrific.
You know, I don't know the full story with Mississippi John Hurt, but he was discovered late in life, right?
Yeah.
It kind of had been playing and singing and was more or less not commercially very well known. Until
he was rediscovered. He was commercially, he was doing well with the Black Race Records in the 20s, and he was rediscovered by the guys from Washington, D.C., I forgot their names.
The Smithsonian, like Moses Ash and those guys?
No. Tom, I forgot his name. No, these guys just rediscovered old blues singers. I mean, there were guys that went around and just collected old 78s, like Nick Pearls and people like that. Obviously, the Lomaxes, Sam Charters. But there were two guys that discovered or rediscovered Son House and Skip James and Mississippi John Hurt. And I met those guys at the Gaslight Cafe in New York, which was a real thrill. It was a highlight of my life. And my friend Stefan Grossman and I went out to, in 64, we went out to L.A. And we started a band. It was Stefan and I and a kid by the name of Ry Cooter. And we played for a week at the Ash Grove. We were called the Gramercy Park Sheiks. And we stayed in an apartment that Mississippi John Hurt was staying in also. So I got to be close to, we stayed together for a week, and I got to be pretty close to John. Wonderful, wonderful human being. I mean, his music was very melodic compared to Son House and not so much Skip James, who did a lot of melodic music also. He was another gentle person.
And what kind of music did the Sheiks play?
Did the Gramercy Park Sheiks play? We played country blues.
Yeah.
We played stuff like, you want me to play one?
Sure, if you'd like.
Okay. Take your fingers off it, don't you dare touch it, you know it don't belong to you. Take your fingers off it, don't you dare touch it, you know it don't belong to you. Two old maids are laying in bed, one turns over to the other and says, take your fingers off it, don't you dare touch it, you know it don't belong to you. Take your fingers off it, don't you dare touch it, you know it don't belong to you. Take your fingers off it, don't you dare touch it, you know it don't belong to you. A nickel is a nickel and a dime is a dime. I got a house full of children and none of them's mine. Take your fingers off it, don't you dare touch it, you know it don't belong to you. You know it don't belong to you. Take your fingers off it, don't you dare touch it. You know it don't belong to you. Well, I may be little and I may be thin, but I'm an awful good daddy for the shape I'm in. Take your fingers off it, don't you dare touch it. You know it don't belong to you. I mean, you know it don't belong to you. On and on, there's all kinds of verses.
I can hear a kazoo solo in there somewhere, maybe.
That was actually the Memphis Jug Band from 1927. And
they did that song?
They did that song, yeah. And we did stuff, Memphis Jug Band, Cannons, Jugs, Stompers. Stefan and I were in a band, the first band I was ever in, was called the Even Dozen Jug Band.
Oh, really? I didn't know you were in.
I was the washboard player.
Oh, wow.
I played washboard because everybody else played guitar, so I figured if I want to stay in this band, I better learn to play another instrument. And, it was me and John Sebastian and Stefan and Maria Muldaur.
I love that band. I just didn't make the connection.
Oh, thank you.
You had a bell on there and everything?
Yeah.
On the washboard?
I put it on my lap. Yeah. I put it on my lap because basically I learned how to play from bongos that I used to play when I was a beatnik, the aforementioned beatnik era.
The beatnik years, volume one.
Excuse me.
Speaking of volumes, this book is called Blood, Sweat, and My Rock and Roll Years. Blood, Sweat, in my rock and roll years, trying to get the same cadence to Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
Subtitled
is Steve Katz a rock star?
Yeah.
That's
from a magazine that, when Blood, Sweat, and Tears became a hit band, and I was still, traveling out to my parents' house for chicken soup and pot roast. And fresh linens, the writer said, is Steve Katz a rock star?
How did your parents handle your success during that era? Did they get it?
Well, when I became a musician, when I left college to become a musician, actually, it's a funny story by itself. My parents weren't happy about that.
My brother's a professional musician, and to this day, at age 60 and very successful. My parents have passed, but when he would when they would talk, they'd say like, he has a gig, like it was a big deal, like, oh my God, he's gonna eat, it's gonna be okay. And to them, it was just the most. They were not happy about it.
They weren't happy about it. They wanted me not only to be a doctor or a lawyer, they wanted me to be a doctor and a lawyer. That's how much pressure was on me. But when I had my first hit record with Blood, Sweat, and Tears, my mother called me and said, Stephen, we knew it all along. but it was funny because when I decided to quit school, it was because I auditioned for the Blues Project, which is a story unto itself.
Now, is this college or high school?
I was in college. Okay. Yeah, a CW post college. My English class was in Dina Merrill's Dollhouse. Dina Merrill was the daughter of Marjorie Merriweather Post, and she had her dollhouse was pretty large, but pretty small for an English lit class. And I was teaching guitar on the weekends at Fretted Instruments on Sixth Avenue, and I had a paper due in a few weeks on Yeats and the Byzantium poems. Now I don't know if you've ever read Yeats and the Byzantium poems, but there's nothing more boring in the world than Yeats's Byzantium poems. I'm sure they're wonderful, but if you give it to a kid now to read, they'd probably throw it back at you or something. It was really, really boring. And then I joined the Blues Project, and I started smoking grass. I bought myself some bell bottoms. I had like a chic hippie girlfriend from England. I was on stage playing. I mean, so I had a choice of doing the Yeats poem paper or living the good life and playing music and having fun. So what would you do?
Yeah, that's a
well, that's the thing. It changed my life. That was the watershed moment.
I'm sure the stories, you've been asked this so many times, but Blood, Sweat, and Tears, just the, I just can't imagine being that well known and going through a phase like that, where, music's all over the radio, people know your songs, sing along with them, and that kind of First of all, it's kind of nice to know that folks that are really talented can get really famous. It's not always mutually exclusive. A lot of people, I think, think that.
Yeah.
But is that – do you have a lot of clarity about that period, or is it sort of a blur? Because it seems to me like it would move – must have been really fast.
I have a lot of clarity about the period. I don't have a lot of clarity about, like, the gigs that we played.
Yeah.
Because after a while, every gig was like a 10,000-seater. The backstage has always looked the same. But I do have clarity about what it was like to go through that. And it was basically a very positive, wonderful experience. We won 3 Grammy Awards. Louis Armstrong gave us the Grammy.
Wow. And,
Tennessee Williams, I had it turned down. He called me up and asked us to do a benefit, you know. And Elizabeth Taylor used to hang out with us. And I had a conversation with Groucho Marx at a party that was thrown for us. And sat and had a conversation with Robert Mitchum, and stuff like that was really, really fantastic. And I just loved it. It was a great experience. It was a lot of hard work. People don't understand. When you have hit records, you're working all the time because you're not only playing Pittsburgh and Cleveland, you're playing everything in between, you know, whatever colleges there are. So you have to get up at like 5 o'clock in the morning and take a plane somewhere, or, you know, get on the bus, then go to a sound check. And then at night you're with promotion people, radio people, and, you know, you maybe get 5 hours sleep and stuff like that, you know, and you're on the road for 6 months at a time. So I can understand how it's a lot of young musicians couldn't really take that. And it was very difficult, you know, combined with some of the drugs and stuff like that.
Well, I think the stamina that you need to have.
Not physically,
but also just emotionally and mentally.
You need to be in pretty good shape.
Yeah. Yeah. And you've not ended up because you haven't ended up anything.
Thank you. That's good to know.
An old friend of mine who's
I'm not fully woken up.
An old friend of mine who's blind has the standard question when somebody says, "Have you been blind all your life?" He says, "Not yet."
That's great.
But I know you were at Mercury for a while, right?
Right.
Doing A&R and then at Green Linnet.
Right.
So you must have had great empathy for the artists and the musicians you were working with.
I always did. That's always been number one, is the respect and the love I had for some of the musicians and the music that they were making. Green Linnet is a perfect example. I mean, I was working with these Celtic musicians that are just geniuses. I mean, incredible guys like, you know, Kevin Burke, bands like Alton and Capercaillie. I mean, it was just an incredible thing to be able to work with people like that. As far as Mercury Records, that was different. That was the corporate world during the disco era. And the only thing that, I mean, I wound up hiding with Horselips for 3 albums in Ireland, so I got out of the office. But the only thing that it was very difficult to get people signed that I wanted to get signed. For various reasons, but I did get NRBQ signed. I almost got fired over that. And, of course, they didn't sell any records because the company didn't promote it, but they did NRBQ Yankee Stadium, which is still a classic album, and I'm proud of that.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine that being a bad thing to sign NRBQ.
but I learned contracts and stuff like that and just how the record companies screw the artists and it was an interesting time.
I'll bet.
Yeah.
And what do you think? Gosh, there's so much I would love to just talk about. But today, I mean, you've had a chance to really see from the artist's perspective and the label's perspective that whole world. And it's pretty much turned on its head today now. I don't know if record labels have the kind of clout they once had. Everybody can be his own.
No, they don't. There was a point when you had no choice. You signed with a record company. There was no internet. If you did just independent local stuff, it would stay like that because it was before radio was Burkhard Abrams that made radio like homogeneous across America, which was really one of the ends of rock and roll as far as that video and. You know, there's an interesting book by the drummer from they did, I think they were called Semisonic, and the book and the song that they had a hit record was Chemistry. And the drummer wrote my favorite book about music. And he talks about a promotion man when they had their, you know, when they were, had a number one record. And their promotion man in some city, Chicago, whatever, said, I'm taking you guys for a fantastic dinner tonight. So the promotion man takes them out for this incredible dinner. And the drummer says to him, well, you know, do you get a receipt, you know, from this dinner? And he says, oh, yeah. What do you do with the receipt? I send it into the main office. He says, and you get paid back for this, right? He says, yeah. He says, well, in that case, I'm buying you dinner, right? Because it comes off of my royalties.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's it in a nutshell as far as, like, record company contractual, and that's how much they take away from you. But that's sort of a microcosm about what the industry is all about. So sort of, the record companies are sort of getting their comeuppance.
Most of our staff here are musicians. We joke, it's amazing how much people want to pay you in exposure for playing.
And, yeah.
Club owners that insist on your selling tickets or getting a certain amount of folks in the door. And I think a lot of younger people are starting to learn that they should allow their art to be valued and actually should band together somewhat as a community and not allow that kind of culture to take place.
There were a few artists that were smart enough to keep their masters, you know, at the end of the period. David Bowie was one. Frank Zappa was another. Ray Charles was another. There's another one. I forgot who it was, but they kept their masters, and it was the smartest business move that they could make.
Yeah, I think Don McLean, you know, kept all his publishing rights. I don't know if he kept his masters, but
yeah.
It's rare, though, right, that somebody has that prescience.
Yeah, publishing is sort of different. I mean, I kept most of my publishing rights, and whatever I gave away has to be administrated. So I don't mind letting Sony administrate, because I'm not going to go out there and collect the money on my – so I don't mind that. But it's really the owning your master tapes is the most important thing. Publishing is very important, of course, but it's different. But I really have a lot of respect for the people that kept their publishing.
Is that because of all the derivative works that can be made – from them, or is it just a pure?
Of course.
Okay.
Blood, sweat, and tears. They license things that nobody asks this permission.
Wow.
They're allowed to license things wherever they want, you know. So they, you know, they do these like K-Tail type, and you know, there goes whatever respectability we have.
And that's the label that does
Sony,
the licensing.
Sony licenses. So they all the record companies license to other record companies. You know, if they figure they can make more money in a license deal, that's what they'll do.
Yeah, we just never think of this stuff. This is Steve Katz. You're listening to a great guitarist. He was one of the founders of Blues Project and Blood, Sweat, and Tears. You might know him best for that. I'd love to make sure we get some more music. Could you play something else?
Sure. My God, what will I play?
Well, while you're thinking, tonight, if you're listening at WSAJ Grove City, you are not far from Mercer, where you can hear Steve tonight. He's going to be at a place called Jay Hicks on the Square at 7:30 this evening in Mercer. And he's here this morning by courtesy of Harmony in the House. Dennis and MJ, thank you very much. They brought him in for Harmony in the House, and it's great that there's as one of my parents would say, you got two gigs in a row. Oh my gosh, you know. I would like tell my parents, you know, that I got straight A's at Carnegie Mellon and a double engineering degree, and they would say, Dave's got a gig tonight, you know.
What you're hearing in the background is me going into open G tuning.
We encourage tuning. Tuning's a good thing.
Yeah, it helps. But I do so many things, as do a lot of people in open tunings. And the sad thing is that guitars don't tune themselves. It's also the wonderful thing. And you have to talk in between while you're doing the tuning. So it brings me back to that old 60s folk music thing. Here's a Chinese folk song called Tuning.
Josh Hoyt Jr. was here, and he broke a string, and he had about a one-minute song that he played while, I guess he sang a cappella while changing the string. It was kind of neat to watch. That was his thing.
Well, I'm going to do a song that I had written some years back. Because I wanted to write a song about what it was like during the village, you know, being in the village at that time. I used to get a call from Van Ronk, you know, after a couple of years of taking lessons. I got very close with Dave and his wife, Terry. And when I got my junior license, he'd give me a call because I was out in Long Island. And he'd say, can you get your parents' car tonight? And I would say, sure, where are we going? He says, well, and I usually pick up him and Dylan and Phil Oakes, and we go driving around, you know, to record companies. We'd wind up at the Gaslight Cafe on McDougal Street, and right next to the Gaslight, late at night, we'd wind up at the Kettle of Fish Bar, which was like the folk music equivalent of the White Horse Tavern, where Brendan Behan and Dylan Thomas drank themselves to death. And it was great for me. I was just a kid, and I would listen to Dylan talk about Hank Williams and Phil Oakes wishing he was Bob Dylan, and it was just it was lots of fun. So I wrote the songs. I changed some names. Tim, who was a Wobbly, was actually Van Ronk, who was one of the only people at that time in the IWW, still in the IWW, the International Workers of the World. This is called The Kettle of Fish. The sawdust smelled so good to me, and the whiskey poured like rain. There was an orange glow in the New York snow, with the laughter and the pain. And kids said, Sam, when you become a man, there'll be a new day coming on. Play guitar for yourself, don't you mind the rest. They'll be here, but they'll be gone. I knew Sam, who was a Marxist, and Phil the soldier too. And I remember all the ideals, but we drink to the revenues. And there was one who made it lucky, and there was one who took his life. But there was drink to cloud confusion for the kid who did survive. It's the kettle of fish tonight, and we'll drink by the candlelight and talk of wars and greed and whores and the power and the might. It's the kettle of fish in circles by a drunken village dawn, and the crowd grows thin as the sun pours in, and all my friends are dead or gone. Tim, who was a Wobbly, and we drank to the 50 years, from barroom fights to coal mine strikes, how laughter turned to tears. And when the waiter said, hey, Tim, let's go, you drank too much for now. We trade songs in a local cafe, and the kid was in a cloud. Well, my feet were cold like the sawdust, and my eyes were red with tears, like the country blues with the morning news. There was conflict in the air. And are you happy writing songs of love as you watch the dawning light? But you'll miss the walk to the beer and talk in the cave.
night. It's the kettle of fish tonight, and we'll drink by the candlelight and talk of wars and greed and whores and the power and the might. It's the kettle of fish in circles by a drunken village dawn, and the crowd grows thin as the sun pours in, and all my friends are dead or gone.
That's a heck of a song, my gosh.
Thank you. Thanks.
Did you hang out with Phillips much? He's, and I know Dennis loves him too. I've been a fan of his for a long, long time.
Yeah.
And I often wonder what he would be doing were he alive today. I've said that to myself 10 years ago, longer ago than that. His songwriting, it's just a genius.
He was brilliant. I think that Phil might have suffered a little bit from bipolar. And I also felt that that when the war ended, that sort of like put a damper on his whole life, actually.
Yeah.
And that combined with his mental problems. And it was very sad. I loved Phil. He was a wonderful person.
I guess it's called There But For Fortune. There's a book. I think that's the name of it, which
excuse me.
Is a really detailed biography of him that I think is that's it, right? That's pretty accurate.
And there was a side of him, you know, aside from the political thing, and Pleasures of the Harbor is one of my favorite songs on earth.
Yeah, oh, he's a poet. Just an amazing guy. It was Bob Gibson knocking around at that time at all?
I think he may have been at the Gaslight Cafe and one or two of the hoots where everybody played, but not really. Now, he wasn't part of the scene there, you know. I mean, I remember him. Was it Bob Gibson and Bob Camp at the Newport Folk Festival?
Yeah, Hamilton Camp. And Bob Gibson. This is Steve Katz. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Saturday Light Brigade. Thank you for doing that. It's so natural to say Steve Katz of Blood, Sweat, and Tears of Blues. Does that ever go away? It probably doesn't.
No, it doesn't. Well, the Blues Project was a. I was very proud of the Blues Project, and we did some wacky music. We were five lunatics that. But it was a brotherhood, you know. Yeah. Blood, Sweat, and Tears became more of a corporate thing because, of course, all the lawyers and. And managers jumped in, but the Blues Project was really a wonderful experience for me.
Yeah, and just in terms of artistic impact, I mean, you guys were breaking new ground.
It's too bad that we had such a terrible record company because, you know, like 1.5 of our records were live because they didn't have a budget for us to be in the studio, and... I remember when we were doing Projections, our second album, and Tom Wilson was producing, but he was also producing Eric Burdon and the Animals, or Eric Burdon. And if our 3 hours were up, and I remember doing my song, I was like a little flat on a couple of parts. I said, Tom, can I redo my vocal? And he said, no, Eric's waiting to come. So and then you have to live. But that song, you want to hear a funny story?
Sure.
Then I'll sing the song also. But I wrote a song called, it was actually the first song that I wrote. It was called September 5th. And we recorded it on Projections. And when the album was ready to go, our manager got a phone call from MGM and said, well, Jeff, we have the tapes, we have the artwork, except we're missing the name of the second song on the first side. So our manager is on the phone with him. He says, second song, first side, second song. Oh, that's Steve's song. Thanks, Jeff. So I get back off the road, and like a week later, I'm looking at the proofs, and it says Steve's song. I said, what the hell is this? This is not the name of my song. And, you know, I tell audiences, you know, that, you know, you could have like a child that dies very sadly, or a dog or a cat, you know, but, you know, when something like this happens, you've got to live with it forever. So I'm one of the reasons why I'm doing my tour and wrote my book was so people will know that I would never, ever name a song after myself.
This is September 5th.
September 5th. And yeah, we did it like, you can't call me from a snow-white starlit stairway. Drums, bass, and, you know, keyboards. I'm going to do it the way I wrote it. Call me from a snow-white starlit stairway. I may hear and not be far away at all. But the sounds of our winter's love at nighttime, they have vanished, they have silenced into fall. You can crystallize through my mind's weary wanderings. I may see your shadowed image on my wall. Half staring, laughing, weaved by your indifference. I would rather feel the pain than none at all. If again I really see your face before me, and we lie again together side by side, don't call me as I walk into the morning. Please just realize that the pure has often died. Couple of mistakes, but what can you do about it? It's life.
It's life. It's live. It's. I was just looking at your website. Oh, there's somebody cheering.
Thank you.
Out there, that's John Binley, a great musician in his own right, heading out to Wilkinsburg today, where we will be. Our Youth Express internet radio service, all youth, all the time. John's going to be helping some teens host radio all afternoon. Rain Dio, maybe we'll call it. There's tents out there, so I hope they will be in tents, whether they want to be or not. We have maybe 3 to 4 or so minutes of radio time left. This has really gone fast. Is there anything you'd like to mention? I mean, one was that you just sort of got the title of that song out there. But is there anything else we haven't talked about?
We haven't talked about Lou Reed, who I produced for
a few
albums.
Yeah, you produced his, I can't remember the name of the album, the
Rock
early...
and Roll Animal?
Yeah.
Sally Candy, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was. There's a lot of about Lou in the book. There's another story that may not be suitable for radio or anything else, actually. But there's one funny story. When we did Rock and Roll Animal, we took the tapes back to the studio, and we were missing an audience track. In those days, there were no digital delays. You had to do, you know, stereo audience track.
Sure.
You had to have two mics out there, and somebody stepped on a cable or something happened in the record plant remote, So we take the tapes back to the studio, and we're missing an audience track. So I said to my engineer, Gus, what are we going to do? He said, well, I got an idea. Let me go into the archives and see what I can pull out. He goes into the archives. He says, I got another audience track. We can put that in. I said, what is it? He says, from a John Denver concert. So Lou went to his grave not knowing that half of the applause on his biggest selling album was from a John Denver concert. And I figured that if Lou was still alive and he found out or read my book, it would kill him anyway.
Do country boy. Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, yeah. And wouldn't it be funny if there was really print through from...
It'd be funny if the applause from Lou Reed were superimposed on Denver.
You're in the middle of heroin. You heard a little bit of Take Me Home, Country Roads, West Virginia, Mountain Mama.
I can't wait to read the book. It's called Blood, Sweat, and My Rock and Roll Years as Steve Katz, a Rock Star. I think if you just Google Steve Katz, you'll find it. And I was just looking at your website, and there's a lot to learn and enjoy there, too, particularly the discography, which is complete and interesting.
I think that if you go to the archives also, there's some funny pictures like me and Eric Clapton smoking a joint backstage at Winterland. Stuff like that.
Wow.
There's a picture of me and Stefan and Rye. And
well, check it out. It's at stevekatz.wordpress.com. And we're plumb out of time. Thank you.
I was having so much fun.
Thank you for being with us
today. Thank you for having me.